Good evening, you guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we're picking the TechNet, as we've done for three some odd years. Main purpose of the TechNet is education. Curious radio amateurs who want to know more about their radio equipment, radio in general, gather here and teach each other how their transmitters and receivers and antennas and transmission lines and propagation, 27 or so different kinds of ham radio, how this stuff all works. There is a supporting pair of websites that go along with the TechNet. One of them is by Mike number 1, KC2NJI. That's at amateurradio.tv, amateurradio.tangovictor. And there you'll find supporting information for the TechNet and recordings of the last 10 years, 10 and a half years, I think it is, of TechNet. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back the recordings. What's going on tonight will be placed on that TechNet, on that website, probably Wednesday or so. Let me drop. And there's some other articles and other information there. The second website that supports the TechNet is by Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's at limontechnet.com, limontechnet.com, and there you'll find photographs, articles, Smith charts, all kinds of useful things that support the TechNet. Let me try.
No echo link tonight. Your echo link is down.
Okay, let's see now. Yeah, right now I'm seeing that the we're not being repeated to the repeater on 147.375. So, Eric, KE2EJ, are you available? K2RIW on the TechNet?
I had to bring up my remote base. WD2HW, you know me, I wanted to listen on echoing. Somebody dropped my remote base. Just wanted to let you know that you had a technical problem.
Eric, I think I briefly heard your voice. 20 or 30 dB weaker than normal. Very, very weak in the background. I heard your voice. So I guess you are familiar with the fact that we're not being repeated to the 375.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Now
I can hear me.
Okay, you can hear me now, right?
Roger that. You're hearing your loud and clear now. So I guess you're working on the problem. Is that true, Eric?
No, all of Leno says no. Telephones and internet service, so that's one problem. I brought up another amplifier to fix the link problem, so that's another issue.
Okay, sometimes the audio doesn't come through, or it comes through very delayed. Good luck, by the way. You did a good job on replacing that receiver that had hum on it. There's no hum on that receiver. You know the one I'm talking about. So, no internet connection, no telephone, and that's what you're... I guess you're at the site and repairing it right now. Is that true, Eric? K2RIW?
Yeah, Dick. Well, there's nothing I can do about the internet, so there's no echo link. Oh, hello. What is that? There's no echo link or IRLP. There's no link to 375, but once I get finished with this, then we'll have a radio link to 375 again.
Every so often, the audio cuts out and then comes back on with a blast. I guess you're saying that you believe you'll have the 375 and Echo Link restored probably in a half hour or something like that. Eric, it's going to take a while because of the amount of things that are not working right now. Is that true? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, Echo Link I got no control over. IRLP I got no control over. But the radio link should bring us 375, but I don't know. Maybe a half hour, an hour, if I don't knock this thing off the air.
Understand. So, I believe that the Echo Link and IRLP all works through their 375 machine. So, therefore, I think what we're saying is that people out of the New York City area I'm not going to be able to hear the TechNet tonight until that 375 machine is operational again. Is that roughly true? KE2EJ, K2IW.
Actually, the people that are gathering on IRLP are probably listening to 375 with nothing on it, so you might go over there and make an announcement that there's an issue.
Okay, I'll try doing that. Stand by.
K2EJ and 2EO, could you tell me why the repeaters are repeatedly shut off on me and Barry?
Hello, Eric, K2EJ, WDK, Stony W. How are you, Eric?
I'm fine, Harry, but I'm kind of busy, so I'm not answering anybody's questions at the moment.
Fine, I'll be listening. I'm going to put this thing into receive only mode. All right, K2EJ, now clear.
I made the announcement on 375, and the guys over there said they're patiently waiting for the audio to come out of 375, Eric. Okay, so looks like we've got a portion of the system working tonight. As you guys have already heard, the main reason for the TechNet is education. That's what's going on for the last 1982 to now, which is, what, 34 and a half years. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment. He does so by giving us his call letters, his name. Try to remember to give me the name because I'm so forgetful. And the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening, you need not sign in to say you're listening. After 34 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven anymore. So for those who want to check in, because they do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. And make sure you wait for the beeps in between so we don't time out the machine. K2RIW TechNet listening.
And to Leo, with a comment, a technical comment.
WHYY Joe, yes.
Okay, so far we've got Rich and Joe. Anyone else to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the net, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, TechNet. One last call. Anyone out there with a question or a comment that wants to check in to the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now.
WS2M, Paul with the Space Report. Good evening there.
Very fine, Paul. And I sent you an email, which you probably got, with reference to a fairly interesting subject. And you're about to give us a Space Report number 249. Is that true, Paul, all of the above? WS2N, K2RIW.
And that's true, and thanks for that email. And one email like that leads me from one topic to another. So, very, very good. You know, next thing I know, it's an hour later, I'm researching all these different missions. Back to you then.
So I think you're saying the subject of that email is something that hadn't come to your attention yet. I wasn't just duplicating something you were already familiar with. I actually got something there to you slightly ahead of time. Over to you, Paul.
Yes, that's because it just came out. In fact, I heard it on CBS News today. So about the plans that NASA is doing for the future. So yeah, that's new news back here.
Okay, very fine, Paul. So we've got check-ins from Rich, Joe, and Paul. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet, because you do have a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening. Okay, maybe we'll have some late check-ins later. If not, maybe we'll have a light night tonight. In which case, Joe, who's got a real question, he always does, we'll be able to give him a whole lot of time if he's interested. Rich has a comment, and 2EO. K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, and 2EO. You may remember
I commented a report, a Kinect Systems CF-800, which is a DMR radio, and I called Kinect Systems to find out if they have a desk mic, which they don't. It turns out from what they said, and he wasn't sure, a fellow named Chris, that the Kenwood mics have wired the same as the CF-800. Boy, I took a leap of faith, bought, it's an MFJ 297 desk mic and the appropriate cable for Kenwood. The mic is very well made, and I'm very happy to say it works perfectly on my CF-800. Some of the buttons don't work, but they can be reassigned via software and the code plug. I have to figure out how to do it. Also, there's a gain control on the mic, because I have my gain up very high in the CF-800. There was way too much gain for the desk mic. So there's a gain control. I turned it way down. And the final thing is on the enemy set. There was a switch on the bottom of the MFJ 297. One side is a slide switch. One side is marked FM. The other side is marked single sideband. It comes in the FM position. But when I listen to it, Weimark has something called the Parrot. On the Weimark Parrot, it will repeat back to you in your own voice everything you said. It was way too bassy. When I switched to the single sideband mode, it sounded fine. Then I'll hook it up. There were two RJ45s on the back of the mic. You have to plug the appropriate cable for Kenwood into jack B and set the switch on the bottom. There's a slide switch marked ABC. You set that to B. And that's the story. Back to net and to Rio.
Sounds like good information for people who have that Kinect Systems DMR radio and want a desk mic. Looks like you've solved that problem. I think I've heard about the Parrot before, but I don't know very many of the details. If a person wants to know how his voice is sounding coming through the repeater, I do it by running the full duplex mode. I mean, all of these years, whenever I'm running the TechNet, I've got my transmitter that you're listening to during the transmitting. I have a second receiver connected to a separate antenna listening to what's coming back out of the repeater, and that goes into a set of earphones. So if any of my words get drowned out for any reason, I know which words are not coming through, and I know about by running full duplex. Very few people do that, and I'm kind of amazed. It's very, very useful to know how well you're getting through, particularly in the case of running a net. If some of your words don't come through and you don't know about it, then the people doing the listening have a discontinuous message, if you know what I mean. So, this Parrot, how does one go about addressing the Limon Parrot? What do you do in order to make a recording of your voice on the Parrot and have it play back to you? N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. It took me a long time to figure out the code plug. And I did have some help. But once you set up a zone is where you put the channels. You have to put in the channels for IMOC. And one of the channels is called the parrot, the Limelight parrot. Exact frequencies, I don't know, because I have to hook them up in the software.
Okay, I'm going to make a guess out of what I just heard, Rich. Is this parrot function through Limelight something that is available by way of a DMR radio? If I am not using DMR, I'm using old-fashioned analog right now, would I be correct in guessing that this parrot function for me without a DMR radio, parrot function is not available for me? Is that approximately true? N2EO, K2IW.
That is exactly true. You're going out DMR and it comes back DMR. And it's very convenient because when you let go of the mic, there's about a 3 second delay before it comes back.
And I guess people who have actually listened to a DMR QSO and then listened to the parrot come back, I guess they've already been convinced that the parrot does a high fidelity reproduction, recording and reproduction and playback, and therefore whether or not your voice is too bassy, too shrill, too high, too low in amplitude and so on, the parrot lets you know about that. But sounds like a very handy function. Back to you for any clarification on that, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That is exactly true. You hear your own voice as if it was somebody else coming back to you, say, on a Limelight Club frequency or on Northeast Connect or anywhere else. So it's exactly perfect. And by the way, side comment, I'm pretty happy with the CSA tone. I think it's a wonderful radio. When I spoke with Chris, which is a gentleman who answers questions at the Connect Systems, said at one time 90% of their business was amateur with commercial. 10% was amateur. He said now the business has switched. It is now 90%. Amateur, 10% commercial. He's going to be at the Limelight booth. So anybody, I'm sorry. He's going to be at the Dayton booth. So you can see the radios that they make at Dayton. And he's so interested, he's picking up a MFJ 297. And myself and him are going to figure out in the code parts how to get the other buttons to work, mainly the up-down buttons. You can go into the code part and assign functions. That's all we have to do.
That's very interesting that Kinect Systems used to be 90% commercial, 10% ham. Now it's 90% ham, 10% commercial. Is that because the market has been saturated, the commercial market has been saturated with the Kinect Systems radios, or is it because of such a high percentage of people needing a commercial radio are really using cell phones, wireless techniques these days? What's your guess there, Richie? You think it's cell phones, or do you think they've saturated the market? N2EO, K2RIW.
I really don't know, Dick, but I do know the Motorola's, which they sell, are way more money. So hams can't afford the Motorola. And this is very stooching. It's well built. I see nothing wrong with it.
The CS-800 DMR radio. How big is it? Is it a portable? How many watts output? And roughly how many dollars when you buy it? N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Jake. Well, first off, it seems strange to me Sealants like HRO or Gigaparts are not handling it. I bought it on Amazon.com for $314. Came in, I don't know, maybe a week. When I bought the MFJ mic, I bought that from HRO. And it came the very next day. So I guess you have to follow the money.
Roughly how expensive was that MFJ 297 microphone? I think that microphone, MFJ, is it an MFJ brand name or that's just the model number? Is it a Kenwood mic? Over to you, Rich.
It's an MFJ brand. With the shipping, it was $89. And you can't call it Mighty Fine junk. It's not junk. It's very well made. And by the way, if you buy one, it takes two AA batteries. And they're not included, so you gotta get them ready for batteries.
What's your guess, Rich, as to what the batteries are doing inside that microphone? Many of the mics you and I use and much of our equipment is really powered by the front panel of the equipment the mic plugs into. And what is this mic doing? Is there a memory circuit of some kind in there that has to be held up with those batteries? Or maybe that's operating the audio preamplifier? What's your guess? It's unusual for a microphone to require batteries. And I'm going to guess it's a pair of AAAs or something like that, N2EO, K2LIW.
A pair of AAs. I think that's the electric condenser mic. They require 3 volts.
Do you think the 3 volts out of the two AAs just maintains the condenser mic? And it's not powering a audio preamplifier on that mic? I presume that microphone requires no power to come from the front panel of the transmitter it's connected to. Is that true? Over to you, Rich, K2LIW.
I really don't know, Dick. I haven't checked the pin out. But it controls also that preamp. Because as I told you, I got the gain way down. So there's obviously a preamp in it.
Does anywhere the instruction manuals give you a rough approximation as to how long the batteries are good for in that mic? Is a typical battery replacement 6 months, would you guess, if you happen to know? Over to you, Rich.
But from my experience, they last a lot longer than that. Maybe a year.
Are you saying you have used other microphones from time to time that require AA batteries installed? None of my rigs do that, so which of your rigs have required a microphone with AA batteries inside? Over to you, Rich.
Oh, on my old band radio, a Kenwood mic is called an MC60. It requires batteries only if you're going to use the preamp. There's a switch marked in, out. If the preamp is out, you don't need the battery. And Kenwood supplied me with a pair of Panasonic batteries.
Okay. See, the mic I've got here, Kenwood MC60. And you're talking about a, MC60. I've got the MC60. And I don't see a preamp switch on my MC60 Kenwood microphone desktop mic. So I must have an earlier version. I don't think mine has a preamp. I don't see an in-out switch. Over to you, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Now, turn it over, look carefully. There is a slide switch marked in-out. And that's preamp in, preamp out. If you have it on preamp out, no problem. If you have it on preamp in, you need the batteries. That's what the instructions say.
I must have a much earlier version. My Kenwood MC60 has four buttons on the front panel, down and up, lock and TTT. Nowhere on the back panel, the side panel, or anything else is there an in-out switch. I've seen the inside of this. There's no place inside to mount batteries. So maybe there's more than one version of the MC60 microphone. And maybe I've got the one that was built in the year one. W. Rich.
I really don't know, Dick, but I came on here with this information because I wanted to spread it around that this mic, if you need a desk mic, if you're not putting your CS800 in the car, it works perfectly. Make sure you get the right cable. In fact, when I called HRO, I ordered it from a gentleman named Roy, R-O-Y. Call him up, tell him about our conversation, and he can set you up.
So I presume that there are different cables depending on which rig you're about to interface with. And when you told him you're interfacing with a Kinect Systems DMR radio, CS800, he told you exactly which cord to buy. Is that what you're saying? That's what Roy told you? N2EO, KQLAW.
First of all, Roy is at the Delaware store. So I got him one day. I called him up. I told him that I needed a cable for a Kenwood. Because Kinect Systems told me a Kenwood, he thought, was compatible Kinect Systems. So I took a leap of faith, and I won.
Very fine, Rich. Sounds like a successful story. So good luck with that continued operation. I just checked in. The 375 machine is not yet operational. Okay, Joe is next, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Looks like we got lots of time tonight, Joe, so nice and slowly, tell us what you'd like to discuss. I'll discuss anything except antennas. That's a joke. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-A-W in the tech net. You got a joke.
My question to you and Annette is on the subject of current inrush, how that affects a tube amplifier compared to a solid-state amplifier, high-power level UHF, and then that variety, like 200, 300 watt amplifier. Is it more detrimental on a tube amplifier or a solid-state amplifier, that type of effect? I'm talking about it. You're taking the amplifier, keeping it off your, fairly rapid cycling where it may be on for like 30 seconds, off for 5 seconds, or on for 30 seconds or a minute. On-off type of cycling. Which one is going to be less affected by current inrush?
Yeah, I'm having a little bit of trouble believing that a well-designed rig will be troubled by inrush. Where inrush really comes in full blast is if a guy is running a kilowatt amplifier, quite often a tube type. He's got a really stoochy power transformer feeding a full-wave bridge rectifier, and most rigs that are used by ham radio operators for foolish reasons have a capacitor filter network on the bridge rectifier coming off the transformer. So if you've got a power supply, it's a 2-3 kilovolt power supply, and if the instant at which you turn the on-off switch for that amplifier power supply on, if a Long Island Lighting Company or Piper or New Jersey Power and Light, I can't think of the name of the company, if they happen to be at the peak of the 60 cycle sine wave, which is really a positive 167 volts, if they're at 167 volts positive or negative, at the instant your switch closes, you've now got an irresistible force and an immovable object. Let me drop that. If you've got your very stoochy hypersil transformer, which has very little winding resistance on its primary and secondary windings, operating into a bridge rectifier into your filter capacitors. One of the universal laws of electronics is that you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. So you've got these filter capacitors, many microfarads, thoroughly uncharged. You've got the peak of 167 volts. That's if you're running it on 120. I guess you've got 330 volts, roughly, peak voltage if you're running it on the 220-volt power supply. You've got 330 volts coming from the pole pig transformer out in front of your house. That impedance back through your fuse panel, your household wiring, into that pole pig transformer, I don't know what the number might be, but the total amount of resistance there might be 1 ohm. You've got 330 volts going through 1 ohm of wiring going into the primary of your transformer. The secondary of the transformer is feeding bridge rectifier into uncharged capacitors. The instantaneous inrush current in that case, if I was a little bit pessimistic, if I represent the instantaneous impedance of your filter capacitors when they're uncharged as being nearly 0 ohms. So you've got nearly 0 ohms after the bridge rectifier, and you've got a primary resistance of around an ohm. 330 volts in 1 ohm means that you might have an inrush current, worst case, of 330 amperes. Obviously, your fuse, your circuit breaker, or whatever, is probably going to trip in that situation, even though it's a very brief spike. So there's a real case of inrush current, which can do damage to the wiring of your house, to your circuit breaker, and so on. But whether or not that's going to damage...
Repeater, time out.
Good thing I'm running full duplex, so I know when I time out. In that particular case, the weakest link in that chain might very well be the bridge rectifier assembly. You're now putting a huge amount of current through that bridge rectifier assembly, and depending on its specification, it can take a one-cycle inrush current of X number of amperes. Could it take 300 amperes? I doubt it. Well, the voltage being stepped up to a higher voltage on the secondary of that winding. That secondary winding has a considerably higher impedance, but a considerably higher voltage. So what's the real inrush current to that capacitor through the bridge rectifier that we're going to be? I don't know. Now, if you were following commercial standards, almost every broadcast transmitter, and Eric can confirm this for us, almost every broadcast transmitter, let me drop one, has a choke input filter network after the rectifier assembly for a whole bunch of reasons. One, it's a much more compatible power factor. A choke input power supply doesn't give you these extremely sharp spikes of current that you get with a filter network that's a capacitor input type. So you get much friendlier peak currents. You get much nicer inrush current. You can have peak voltage of the 320 volts that I gave in my example. And if your rectifier network is feeding a choke input filter, the choke absorbs that first cycle. And instead of 300 amperes of inrush current, you might have 5 amperes of inrush current, so to speak. So choke input power supplies are very friendly as far as what it does to power factor, what it does to inrush current. However, for reasons of tradition, I guess, let me drop this. The very few amateur radio operators who are operating rigs, particularly if they build them themselves, that have a choke input filter network. For traditional reasons, I guess, we always have capacitor input filter networks. And there's one slight disadvantage of the choke input type. You'd need a higher voltage coming out of the transformer to operate the choke input type. So that inrush current can do damage to that power supply. The tube itself, I don't think the tube really cares about the inrush current, except maybe in the case of a completely cold filament, a well-designed network on a real high-power tube would start with some kind of a series resistor between the filament transformer and the actual filament of the tube. The filament winding of a tube, the filament element, probably has a huge difference in the resistance when it's hot versus cold. And so when it's cold, it also has an inrush current, which could, I guess, lower the life of the tube if you keep experiencing that inrush current on that filament. Now, let me drop this. You're asking would a solid-state transmitter be more vulnerable to inrush current? And there again, the real difference is how was the power supply designed? Your solid-state rig might have a 48-volt power supply feeding those power transistors. And how is that 48-volt derived? Is that filter network a choke input type or a capacitor input type? So once again, there could be some pretty fierce inrush current there. And so you've got a mixed blessing. If you've got a very well-wired house with, let's say, 10-gauge wiring going from that fuse panel to the shack on 220-volt wiring, so you've got very low resistance. And so, therefore, you've done that to make sure you have very little voltage drop when you go into the transmit mode, and you won't get the light dimming, so to speak. Well, that particular technique of using real heavy-gauge wiring is going to lower the amount of resistance back to the pole pig transformer and therefore drastically increase the inrush current. So a poorly wired house could easily have one-tenth the inrush current because of the amount of impedance of your wiring. So there's a lot of variables in here involved, as you can see, Joe, from my point of view. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Wait for the beeps. K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
W-B-2-H-W-W with a comment on the subject.
Go ahead there, Howie. How much inrush current have you experienced? Have you experienced damage, or do you know of people who have experienced damage and they've done something about it? The right way to do it would be to have a starting resistor. In other words, when you first flip the switch, on-off switch on that power supply, if there is a 10-ohm resistor in the system so that it comes on with a friendly amount of current, and then after the power supply comes up to voltage, a relay shorts out that
repeater timeout.
Once it comes up to full voltage, that relay shorts out that inrush protecting resistor. That would be a very friendly design. Not many rigs are done that way. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Two things. Number one, you beat me to the punch on that. That's called a soft start. They actually had that in some TV sets or some other, and they do that in a lot of commercial equipment. The other comment I was going to make, Dick, is, yes, you have to look at the impedance of your wiring. And if you go to Busman that makes circuit breakers and gray bar, they have all the formulas you need for figuring out what the inrush current is from a typical utility, okay? That's number one. Now, when you're looking at circuit breakers, they have two ratings on a circuit breaker. Circuit breaker will have 30 ampere rating, tell you what the voltage is, but it also has something called AIC, which is ampere interrupted capacity. And that tells you the maximum amount of current that circuit breaker will accept without exploding. Now, they won't trip on inrushes with less than a few cycles, but it's four cycles. I think the standard is they designed it to handle four cycles of the 60 cycles, so many milliseconds. So when you're looking at it, some of your garden variety circuit breakers are 2,500 amps, but a good circuit breaker is 5,000. So you look at the Fetterman's equivalent impedance from the circuit breaker, from the panel box, through the wiring, back to the pole. And there's reasons for that, because you can get dead shorts, metal stuff. When you turn on equipment, they can have a dead short for a split second. So you want to know what the maximum current that a circuit breaker can handle. And the other thing that you comment is called a soft start, Dick, K4RAW, WD2HWW.
So I think you said that each circuit breaker has an AIC rating. And run that by one more time. Ampere interrupt capability or something like that. Go ahead.
Well, interrupt to ampere capacity is the amount of maximum current that a circuit breaker can handle for so many cycles. I think it's four cycles. That's the maximum current that it can handle without exploding or hurting someone. Because a lot of times, that's where people get hurt. Sometimes they'll pull a circuit breaker out in a panel and it can explode. To good idea when you pull a circuit breaker on is to turn your face away from the paddle box.
If that circuit breaker is going to explode, what is in there that has explosive material? It's a bunch of metal contacts with a bunch of insulators. So, are you saying that a circuit breaker in the worst case situation can literally shatter and sprinkle high speeds of particles coming out of that fuse panel? Is that what you're saying, or Howie? Go ahead.
Certainly, ask any electrician. There is, it could be like a flame or something. You know, someday they had different gases in those circuit breakers. It's been so many years ago, but when I worked for the Army Corps of Engineers at 26 Federal Plaza, one of the calculations we would do when we would do, figuring out service is you would have to figure out how much current something, you know, what's the maximum current you could get if you had a dead short, because particles, whatever, or equipment would give you a dead short. So you had to figure out the maximum amount of current, and you had to make sure the circuit breaker could handle it. Now, the heavier the wiring, the lower the impedance. And you also had to calculate the impedance of the windings of the pick pole transformer, because you had to figure out, and you could call the local utility, and they would tell you, well, we can deliver 10,000 amps, 20,000 amps, whatever it is. And you had to make sure that you had a circuit breaker if you were doing it in a commercial setting that it could handle that. And that was rated for 4 cycles, Dick.
Okay. And hopefully in a capacitor input filter network of our ham radio high voltage power supply, maybe within 4 cycles the capacitors would come up to essentially full voltage and they're no longer acting like a dead short circuit. One of the mistakes that a lot of people make under certain circumstances, they want to start using a circuit breaker as an on-off switch. And so to open the circuit breaker to kill all power to the shack when you walk away for the day, maybe that's not so bad. But there are people who will use a circuit breaker day in and day out as an on-off switch for certain pieces of electronics. That is not recommended. The circuit breaker is not intended for that kind of service. The actual contacts in there are supposed to be doing a make and break function a rather small number of times. And so if you're using it as a light switch on off you know, lots and lots of times, you're creating artificial aging. I wonder if you've ever run into ratings along those lines, Howie. So maybe to HWW, K2RIW, the tech name.
Can we have a comment?
Yes, you're right about that. They will tell you what the life cycle is, how many times the circuit breaker can be opened and closed. It's a couple hundred times. And you don't expect the circuit breaker to pop that many times. If you pop it like that, then you have other problems with it, your service or a short. But that's very important. So, you know, whenever you're installing a circuit breaker or having a contractor do it, you want to spec that. And we used to spec that out. You know, we would write that spec. That was a very important spec. And the UL, Underwriters Laboratory, also has a whole booklet on it. But if I remember right, and it was written back in the 50s, there was a great article, and it was in the Busman catalog, because Busman would explain...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Howie, when I buy a circuit breaker with a higher AIC rating, do I have to pay a premium price? And roughly, what's the increase in price for... stand by a minute. What's the increase in price when I go to one with a higher AIC rating? Over to you, Howie.
Know that, Dick. I didn't do the pricing, and this was my first job going back when I first got out of front. So it was my first job working on power distribution, three-phase stuff. And just for history, the first job I actually worked on was at Fort Monmouth. I didn't work at Fort Monmouth, but I worked on some of the rehab work. And I actually went out there to Fort Monmouth when we were doing survey work. And I went out there and I had to deal with a lieutenant and a captain. We had to go through some of the barracks and everything. We were doing not only the electrical, but back then it was right around 1980. The government was getting involved with energy conservation, and we were dealing with EMC. We're standing for Energy Management Control. And we were using Honeywell computers and Honeywell controls, Nick. All right, let me get out of here. I just wanted to make that comment. But as far as pricing, I don't know. And this was many years ago.
Okay, Howie, I thank you for that information. N2EO, what's your experience with circuit breakers, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, Dick. I don't have the expertise on the subject that Howie has, but I can tell you this. I had a full band 86-10-meter amplifier that EastKit made called an SB230. It used an 8873 conduction cooled tube with a chunk of beryllium. And on the front, the on-off switch was indeed a circuit breaker. And when I built that kit, I had a bad feeling. After a while, the circuit breaker would throw out a blue flame, not a flame, an arc. And eventually it went bad. I had to replace it with one from EastKit. And I was very surprised. Very surprised at the engineers at EastKit that did that. See, they had a whole change of engineers in that era. Prior to that, they were all Collins engineers that came over from Collins. After they left, I don't know what happened. I don't know if it was a union thing. I have no idea. But the people that came in just didn't know what they were doing.
Interesting. Now, it was Joe who asked the original question about inrush current. What made you concerned about solid-state versus tube amplifiers and inrush current? What alarmed you in this area that... is giving you concern now, Joe. W-H-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, well, it wasn't Wayne. It was actually somebody else who runs a system of repeaters that have high-power solid-state amplifiers in them. And we're not talking about turning the power supplies on and off and on and off. The power supplies are on. They're running DC. The amplifiers are running Class C. And I'm talking about cycling up the entire amplifier going on, producing power, then going off, very briefly, then coming back on again. That type of cycling. That's really what I was getting at. Not tripping circuit breakers.
So, are you saying that these people who are running equipment that was being subjected to that scenario, were they getting failures which they believe were being caused by inrush current? Over to you, Joe.
Well, the people. Or a person that runs this system, I don't know, would really know the difference. It's just something I brought up because I brought the comment up to him about cycling high-powered solid-state amplifiers, but I don't think they like doing that too much. And the question was, as I brought to the net, which is going to be less apt to give you a problem, cycling a high-power tube amplifier or cycling a high-power transistorized amplifier? I mean, you made strip-line 432 stuff, running a kilowatt at 432, but you're running tubes in this thing. You can run it to CW, you know, it's cycling on very, very quickly. Now, do you think you'd get the same kind of life out of that amplifier if it was running transistors instead of tubes?
Now, when it comes to a kilowatt level, a pair of 4CX250B tubes running at the kilowatt level of power input, 500 watts per tube, and a solid-state equivalent of that, which is going to give you more life and less grief, there's a whole lot of variables involved. But the biggest variable when it comes to inrush current is not the amplifier itself. It's the design of the power supply. And so power supplies and charging networks, there's a real art and science to doing that correctly. In the early days of handheld computers, for instance, Texas Instruments had a charging network for the nickel-cadmium batteries that were in the handheld calculator, which that charging network was a real battery cooker. And there were times when the batteries would run very hot because you you left the charger on for a long period of time, you'll be Packard by comparison, had a much more sophisticated charging circuit where they didn't do that. And I'm sure you've got experience with the Motorola charging networks where some of the battery chargers were well designed and some of them were very poorly designed and drastically shortened the life of batteries. So the design of the power supply, let me drop this. Depending on whether or not the designer of the power supply went all the way with soft start circuits and choke inputs and so on, there's a whole lot of variables involved. So to just make a blanket statement that solid-state or tube amplifiers are more vulnerable to inrush current would not be accurate no matter which answer you gave, because there are good designs and bad designs of the power supply, which in theory has control of the inrush current. So many an amateur is not familiar with the inrush current problem. In the case of a power supply with a high voltage transformer with a capacitor input filter, and you would think that a conservative design would be to have very large filter capacitors, lots of microfarads, so you get very little ripple out of it. The good news is you get very little ripple. The bad news is that you make the capacitors very large, is that on each half cycle, they discharge only a small amount, but it takes them a tremendous spike of current to recharge the capacitor on each half cycle, so that there are certain designs of capacitor filter networks where the spikes of current at the peak of the voltage on each half cycle can be a huge number for a very brief number of milliseconds, and that very high current for a very brief period gives you an average current, which equals the average current of your amplifier. Let me drop. But the dissipation of the instantaneous power dissipation of the secondary winding of that power transformer is a function of I squared R, because the spike of current is very high, and you're squaring that I squared and multiplying it by the R of the resistance of that winding. A choke input power supply versus a capacitor input filter network on a power supply could easily have a 10-to-1 difference in the amount of heat being dissipated by the secondary winding of the power transformer. I know, because I went down that road with that amplifier. I burned up a couple of transformers at first before I ran into the great advantage of choke input. I then wrote the article and recommended a power supply with a choke input filter network. However, just putting a choke input and adjusting the voltages of the secondary winding of the transformer, that's only part of the problem. Let me drop. The good news is that with a choke input filter network, you have very little inrush current. You have very controlled current throughout the full 60-cycle sine wave going into that power supply. And you have a very nice power factor. That's the good news. The vulnerability of a choke-in power supply comes when you turn it off. If the power supply was unloaded at the time you turn it off, the inductive kickback of the inductance of the secondary winding of the transformer can produce, at the time you turn off the switch, a huge amount of spike of voltage, which is an inverse voltage going into your bridge rectifier, and you could be damaging your bridge rectifiers if you don't put a damper circuit in there, a circuit that absorbs those spikes. And so when you look at the schematic power supply for the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier, May issue 1972 QST magazine, April was the amplifier and May was the power supply in that issue, in two consecutive issues. Let me drop. Not only will you see a choke for the input of the rectifier filter network of the power supply, but you'll see a resistor and another capacitor across, a resistor and capacitor, there may be a diode there, but there's a damping network that's intended to absorb the spike that occurs at the instant you turn off the power supply. So each power supply design has got its vulnerabilities. Inrush current or turn off spikes, if you know what I mean. So a reliable, efficient, low ripple, proper voltage, proper current power supply. Many
amateurs think the power supply is the part you don't have to concentrate on. That's the real simple network. And the RF circuitry, they think, is the important part. Well, you can have a gold-plated transmitter, but if it doesn't have a reliable power supply, you may not be on the air. So you got to give it some consideration. I'm going to pass it back to you for any further comments on all of the above. And even another question if you want to ask it, Joe. W-H-R-Y-Y. H-R-I-W in the second half.
It's WW with a comment.
Yeah, stand by, Joe. Go ahead, Howie.
Hey, two, one thing. You most likely had a dial reverse bias on the coil. Your biggest problem is going to be if you're running that in CW, a choke input, because when you unkey your transmitter, or even on sideband, because as you draw, you know, you're drawing a lot of current, and all of a sudden you're not drawing current, LDIGT, the change in current, times, you know, divided by the time is going to create a high voltage backwards, and that might cause problems with the bridge rectifiers. So you probably want to rate those bridge rectifiers for at least 4 to 5 times the current, maybe PIV.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, using a rectifier network that has a much higher peak inverse voltage, that's one way it can give you more current, more protection. But the properly designed damper network knows how many Henrys are in that series choke, knows how much current your amplifier can draw, the amount of joules of stored energy in that choke, one half LI squared, current squared times the inductance in Henrys, tells you how many joules. Once you know how many joules of energy are stored in that choke, you can then design a damper network, a resistor and a capacitor that's across it, that will absorb that peak inverse voltage and keep it below some critical voltage that could give you grief into your rectifier network. So there are ways of putting a damping network, a spiked eliminator, so to speak, on the choke to protect it.
Thank you, choke, Dick, where you put a capacitor across the coil. Something like a swinging choke. You know, I think Collins invented the swinging choke.
Yeah, the swinging choke is a slightly different design. As you start drawing current, and you would normally get a voltage drop in a power supply, if the series input choke filter network is a so-called swinging choke, it's a choke that intentionally partially saturates. As you draw current, the number of Henrys decreases. A decreasing number of Henrys means that you're slowly sliding the input filter network, filter choke, out of the network electronically. And therefore, when a swinging choke is properly designed, you can now have a power supply that when you go from no load to full load, has very little voltage droop. That's the main purpose of that swinging choke. That wasn't to control the spike of inverse flyback current or voltage. It was really to try to make a power supply more constant in voltage output, depending on what the load was. I wonder if you're familiar with that one, Howie. Can it be 2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet? Wait for the beeps.
And to we out.
He said it all about that. Yes, I knew that. I know that that was mainly designed for voltage regulation. And Collins had got the patent, I think. Art Collins was the one that came up with that circuit back around in the mid-50s, Dick. Go ahead.
Yeah, at first it sounds kind of crazy to intentionally design the vulnerability into a filter choke. I think that they built the EI laminations have got an air gap in a certain spot to make sure that the choke will saturate at a certain current, which decreases the amount of inductance. At first it sounds backwards from common sense. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, he also had, he took the swinging choke and put a capacitor across the choke, made a tuned choke that gave it even more regulation. Also, I wonder why companies, not Collins alone, everybody copies each other. By putting the choke on the high voltage side of the line, If you're running a, what do you call it, a center tap, a four-wave center tap supply, you're just as well off putting the choke from the center tap to ground.